Hello, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Into the Killing. In this week's episode, we're going to talk about a serial killer who preyed on men in Manhattan in the early 1990s. So we're going to go back to July 10th, 1992, when the number one song was Baby Got Back by Sir Mix-a-Lot. It was the second hip-hop song to reach number one on the Billboard charts that year. At the end of April, Jump by teenage rap duo Criss Cross hit number one and remained in the top slot for 8 weeks. The biggest movie in America for the third week in a row was Batman Returns, starring Michael Keaton, Danny DeVito, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Christopher Walken. It was directed by Tim Burton. A day earlier, Bill Clinton announced that Al Gore would be his running mate in the 1992 presidential election. On July 10th in Miami, Florida, Manuel Noriega, the former leader of Panama, was sentenced to 40 years of prison for drug and racketeering convictions. In Ocean County, New Jersey, sanitation workers were collecting trash on the side of Highway 72. One of the workers picked up a bag and noticed it was really heavy. He looked in the bag and he found a human head. The police were immediately notified. The police found 6 more body parts in different garbage bags. All the body parts were double bagged and the garbage bags were double tied. Amongst the body parts, they found the victim's wallet. He was 57-year-old Thomas Mulcahy, a salesman with a computer company in Boston, Massachusetts. He was married and he had 4 children. The medical examiner noted that he had been stabbed multiple times in the chest and the abdomen. Ligature marks were found on his wrists, suggesting that, at some point, he had been bound. He was then dissected into 7 parts. His head was removed, and his arms, legs, and abdomen were all cut into 2. Afterward, the body parts were carefully washed. A forensic psychologist thought there were 2 reasons the body parts were washed. The first was to remove any potential evidence. The second is that there is an intimate aspect to washing the body parts that could have been erotic for the killer. The body parts were then put into bags and then they were placed in garbage bags. Then the garbage bags were washed. A bloody saw was found in the garbage along with the body parts. It was determined that it was used to dismember the body. The police learned that when Thomas Mulcahy was murdered, he had been on a business trip in New York City. Mulcahy's wife of 33 years told the police something that she thought might be useful. The year before, she had found a book of matches from a gay bar in one of his pockets. Other sources say it was a pamphlet for a gay bar. Regardless of what it was Mulcahy's wife found, she had learned that her husband was also attracted to men. The police learned that Mulcahy often added an extra day to his business trips so he could go out to gay bars. This is exactly what he was doing on the last night of his life. 2 nights before his body was found, he was at an upscale gay bar called the Townhouse in Manhattan, not far from the World Trade Center. People remembered seeing him at the bar. He appeared to be intoxicated. They remembered him talking to a man with brown hair. But the police couldn't say for sure if Mulcahy left the bar with the man. Nevertheless, a sketch of the man with brown hair was drawn up and distributed to the media. Unfortunately, this did not generate any leads. The police looked at other evidence they found with the body parts. This included the bloody saw, a bedsheet, a shower curtain, latex gloves, and the bag for the latex gloves. One thing the police learned, thanks to the price tag sticker, was that the gloves were purchased at a CVS drugstore on Staten Island. Unfortunately, this didn't help them narrow in on a suspect because Staten Island was home to 500,000 people. It wasn't long before Thomas McKayley's murder went cold. 10 months went by, and no progress was made on the case. Then on May 10th, 1993, the police in Manchester County, New Jersey were called because body parts belonging to a man had been found in garbage bags. Notably, the body had been cut into 7 pieces, washed, and stuffed into garbage bags. The body parts were double bagged and double tied, and the garbage bags had been washed. The body was identified as 44-year-old Anthony Marrero. He was last seen alive 6 days earlier near a bus terminal in Manhattan. Marrero's had been stabbed to death and then dismembered. The police immediately saw connections between the two murders. Specifically, they were both stabbed to death and their bodies were disposed of in identical manners. They were also both last seen in Manhattan and dumped in New Jersey. Like the first victim, it appeared that Marrero had been bound. There were ligature marks on his wrists and ankles. Also, Marrero had a connection to the gay community in New York City. He was a gay sex worker. The police learned a little bit more about the killer during the autopsy. The killer most likely had medical training or training as a butcher. They cut the bodies apart by pulling apart the joints and cutting through the cartilage instead of cutting through the bones. The police also found another clue amongst the bags that the body parts were stuffed into. One of the bags had the logo President's Choice printed on it. President's Choice is a popular store brand in Canada, but it's rare to find President's Choice products in the United States. It turned out that the President's Choice bag could have only come from 9 places in the New York area. One of those places was a grocery store on Staten Island. The grocery store was a short distance from the CVS drugstore where the latex gloves were purchased. This further convinced the police that the killer probably lived or worked on Staten Island, most likely in the area close to the grocery store and the CVS. The forensic team checked for fingerprints on the bags using a technique called superglue fuming. When we touch some items, we leave sweat and oils on the surface that we can't see, and sometimes traditional dusting doesn't reveal them either. When superglue is heated, it releases a gas called cyanoacrylate. The oil and sweat from fingerprints attracts this gas. When it comes into contact with the oils and sweat, it crystallizes and leaves behind a white dust. The technique was developed by 2 Japanese forensic experts in 1977. The fingerprint fuming on the bags revealed 2 partial prints and a partial palm print. They were submitted to the national database, but no match was found. 2 months later, on July 30th, 1993, more body parts were found. This time, the body parts were found in Haverstraw, which is in New York State. It's about 30 miles from Manhattan. A man who ran a hot dog stand noticed that 2 55-gallon drums near a stand had some bags in them. He went to check it out, and he opened one of the bags, and he was shocked to see a face staring back at him. The arms and the head were in the drums, but the rest of the body was missing. The legs and the upper and lower abdomen were found about 9 miles north of the head and the arms. They were in garbage bags that were dumped beside the highway. Like the other 2 bodies, this body had been cut into 7 pieces, and then the pieces were washed. The body was identified as 55-year-old Michael Zakara. Zakara was a regular at a piano bar called the 5 Oaks in Greenwich Village, which is in Manhattan. He was there almost every night. The bar often catered to gay clientele. Sakaar had served in the military as a medic when he was young, but he was eventually released as an undesirable discharge. At the time of his murder, he was a typesetter for the New York Law Journal. Sakaar loved the arts. He painted, sketched, and he played the piano and the accordion. Sakaar liked the finer things in life, like chess, high-end alcohol, and escargot. Although Sakaar had expensive tastes, he often lived paycheck to paycheck. 7 months earlier, Sakaar broke up with his partner of 7 years, and at the time of the murder, he was living with another man. The medical examiner determined that Sakaar had been stabbed in the abdomen and hacked in the head with a machete or a hatchet. The police talked to the bartender at the Five Oaks. She saw Sakaar talking to a white man with brown hair. The bartender had never seen the man before. She noticed that when the man came in, he sat next to Sakaar and started talking to him right away. She assumed that Sakaar knew the man. The bartender went over and talked to them, and Sakaar introduced the man and said he worked as a nurse at St. Vincent's. St. Vincent's is a medical center in New York City. The bartender didn't remember the man's name. She said it was a common name, like John or Mark. Another sketch of the man was created based on the bartender's description. But again, no leads were generated. At this point, the press was aware that a serial killer was preying on gay men in Manhattan. They dubbed him the Last Call Killer. Shortly after Sakaar's remains were found, the police thought that they connected two more murders to the Last Call Killer. One murder happened over a year before Thomas Mulcahy was killed. On May 5, 1991, the remains of 52-year-old investment banker Peter Anderson were found. Anderson had been married, but he and his wife separated about a year before his murder. Anderson was gay, but he wasn't widely out because he was worried that it would affect his career. Anderson lived in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. 2 days before his body was found, he was at a political fundraiser in Manhattan. Then, he and his former romantic partner went to the townhouse bar. It was the same bar that Thomas Mulcahy visited on the last night of his life. Anderson was an alcoholic, and that night, he was very drunk. His former romantic partner booked him a room at the Waldorf Hotel. Anderson got in a cab, but he never checked in to the hotel. The medical examiner determined that Anderson had been stabbed to death and then dismembered. His penis had been severed and it was shoved into his mouth. Anderson's murder had not been connected to the killer earlier for several reasons. The first is that someone said that they saw Anderson in Philadelphia after he was in Manhattan and before he was killed. Since the killer's hunting ground was Manhattan, the police didn't think that man who was last seen in Philadelphia would have been one of his victims. But upon further review, the police determined that the person who saw Anderson was mistaken when they said that they saw him after he went missing. Also, Anderson's remains were found in Pennsylvania, whereas the other remains were found in New Jersey and New York. But there were a lot of similarities. Notably, Anderson had been drinking in Manhattan on the night of his murder, then he was dismembered, his body parts were placed in bags, and then the bags were discarded in the trash. So the police concluded that Peter Anderson was the Last Call Killer's first known victim. Not a whole lot is known about the fifth victim. What is known is that he was 50-year-old Guillermo Mendez, He lived in Schenectady, New York, which is about 160 miles from Manhattan. Like the other victims, Mendez was gay. He was last seen alive on July 16, 1992. This was 6 days after Thomas Mulcahy was killed. The next day, Mendez's arms, legs, and abdomen were found in plastic bags in a landfill in Rotterdam, New York, which is about 3 miles from Schenectady. Mendez's fingertips, penis, and head were missing. His head was found weeks later on August 9th in a cemetery in Schenectady. His fingertips and penis were never found. Although Mendez didn't go missing from Manhattan, the fact that he was a gay man who was dismembered and his body parts were placed in plastic bags made him a possible victim. So while the police were able to add more possible victims to the list, they were no closer to identifying the last call killer. Then, after the murder of Michael Sakara, it appeared that the killing suddenly came to an end. The police had no idea why. They thought that the killer may have died or he was arrested for another unrelated crime. Another possibility is that he moved away. Or he may have changed the way he carried out his murders, that he was being a lot more discreet in his methods. This would make a lot of sense because his murders had started making a lot of headlines. The police put hundreds of man hours into the investigation, but nothing they did led anywhere and the case went cold. Then, 8 years after the last known murder, the investigators learned about a new fingerprinting technique called vacuum metal deposition, also known as VMD. The technique was developed by the United Kingdom Home Office Police Scientific Development Branch in the 1970s. The technique involves putting a piece of evidence in a vacuum chamber. Then a piece of metal, usually gold, is heated to the point where it vaporizes. The metallic vapor is attached to the evidence as a film. But this doesn't make the fingerprints visible. Then a piece of zinc is heated up until it vaporizes and it adheres to the gold, thus making the fingerprints visible. VMD is excellent for finding fingerprints on evidence that has been exposed to harsh or extreme environments. You can also find fingerprints on decades-old evidence. It turned out that the police department in Toronto, Ontario, Canada had a VMD machine. The investigators on the Last Call Killer case sent a dozen bags to Toronto to be tested for fingerprints. They found 16 partial fingerprints on the bags that contained Thomas Mulcahy's body parts and 3 bags that contained Anthony Marrero's body parts. Once again, these prints were entered into the national database. But, once again, no match was found. But the investigators were not discouraged because not every state had submitted all their fingerprint records to the national database. So one of the detectives sent hard copies of the fingerprints to the crime labs in every state. A fingerprint examiner with the Maine State Police Crime Lab received the prints. Maine was one of the states that had not submitted all their fingerprints to the database. So she ran the prints in the state database. She got 30 possible matches. She then compared the hard copies of the fingerprints to the possible matches one by one. To her amazement, she found a set of fingerprints that matched. The fingerprints belonged to a man named Richard Rogers. The reason Rogers' fingerprints were in the system was quite disturbing. On April 30th, 1973, a body was found beside a deserted road outside of Bangor, Maine. It was a shirtless male and he was wrapped up in a tent. The medical examiner determined that he had been struck 8 times in the head with a hammer. It was determined he was 22-year-old grad student Frederick Spencer. The police interviewed people who lived in Spencer's apartment building. One of those people was 22-year-old Richard Rogers. Rogers was also a graduate student. He was studying French. He made a statement to the police that made him a suspect, so his apartment was searched and he was subsequently arrested. After Rogers was arrested, he told the police he had come home and found Spencer in his apartment. Rogers said that Spencer was armed with a hammer and he came at him. Rogers claimed that he wrestled the hammer away from Spencer and then killed him in self-defense. Richard Rogers went to trial in the autumn of 1973. He claimed he acted in self-defense. The jury believed him and he was acquitted. After his trial, Rogers got a nursing degree and he moved to New York City. When the Last Call Killer murders began, Rogers was 41 years old and he was working as a surgical assistant at Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan. He was still working there in May 2001 when his fingerprints were matched to the murders of Thomas Mulcahy and Anthony Marrero. He lived on Staten Island, just a few blocks from the grocery store where the President's Choice Bay came from and the drugstore where the latex gloves were purchased. Rogers was an openly gay man. One thing many people noted about Rogers was how normal he seemed. Many people described him as bland, dull, and boring. The district attorney decided to try Rogers for just two murders, Thomas Mulcahy's murder and Anthony Marrero's murder. That was because they had the strongest evidence in those two cases, which were the fingerprints found on the bags. Richard Rogers went to trial in late 2005, just over 4 years after he was arrested. Even though he was not being charged with the murders of Peter Anderson and Michael Sicara, investigators were allowed to testify about those murders. That was because they were so similar that they showed a pattern. The trial lasted 15 days. The jury deliberated for 4 hours. They found Richard Rogers guilty of both murders. In January 2006, Rogers was sentenced to life with a chance of parole after 30 years. The sentences were to be served consecutively, so he wouldn't be able to apply for parole until he had served 60 years. Rogers has never been charged with any other murders, but suspected that he committed at least 3 other murders. It's possible that he killed more men. Rogers put his victims' remains in the trash, so it's possible that some of his victims' remains made it to the landfill and they are now lost. Richard Rogers has never talked about his crimes, so no one is sure why he stopped killing after the murder of Michael Sicara. Or it's possible that he didn't stop killing, he just became more careful and the murders he committed were not connected to him. Unfortunately, we may never know exactly how many men lost their lives to Richard Rogers. At the time of this recording, 71-year-old Richard Rogers is incarcerated at the New Jersey State Prison in Trenton, New Jersey. He'll be able to apply for parole in 2066 when he's 112 years old. So no one expects him to ever be released. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode about The Last Call Killer. As always, our fact checker, producer, and sound designer was Annelle Cloutier. You can check her out on Instagram. A link to her account is in the description box. If you like this podcast, please subscribe or follow so you don't miss any future episodes. Also, if you enjoyed this podcast, please check out Criminally Listed on YouTube. We have over 275 videos featuring some unsettling and bizarre true crime stories. You can find it at youtube.com/criminallylisted. Well, that's all for this week. Thanks again for listening. Please take care of yourself and stay safe.